Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
It's the Beckler and Shauna podcast, your daily download of X92.9's X Mornings with Beckler and Shauna.
Brought to you by Shane Holmes, offering affordable customization on your new home.
It's Friday, March 22nd, 2024. I'm Beckler.
I'm Shauna.
This is the Beckler and Shauna Pisscast. It's a long Pisscast today because there is a career day interview in the middle, the one we talked about yesterday, with retired Calgary homicide detective Dave Sweet. Interesting conversation, as you can imagine.
Yes.
It's about 15 minutes long. It's right in the middle of the podcast. Also, Shauna, I think there's a few people that corrected you on something you did on etymology later.
Yes. So I was talking about the dormitory and where dormitory came from. And when I was looking it up, one of the ones mixed up a couple terms. So I was...
You said the French word for window is dormir, and they said it's actually
fenêtre.
Fenêtre, yeah.
Which I knew, and I said dormir. Dormir means sleep, and so when it all makes sense when you hear it, it's still talking about sleep. And, but also, the root word for dormant comes from that same dormir, which is sleep. So there you go, dormant.
Well, look at that.
There you go. Anyway.
The need to issue a correction has led to a bonus etymology at the start of this podcast.
Yes, this will all make sense later, I promise.
Excellent. Yeah. We've put out some decent social media content in the last few days.
We have.
You can check that out on either of our pages or on the X92.9 social channels.
Yes. And somebody just asked and said, can you mention your socials again? Because they said you don't mention it all the time.
So, sure.
At Shauna Jefferson is mine. Shauna is spelled S-E-A-N-N-A at Sienna Jefferson. Because my mom sucks.
On all social medias.
It's all the same, yeah.
And mine is at Beckler89. I mostly just use Instagram and TikTok.
Yes.
I am not active on Twitter or Facebook anymore. So at Beckler89. And then, of course, the X929 social channels. We post this stuff on there, too.
Yes.
On today's show, a Terry of the Month nominee. One of the biggest insults you can lob at someone in 2024. It's fairly benign, actually, but it hurts. The etymology that Shauna was talking about. We'll talk about big woos in songs.
Woos.
That career day interview. A new product available that's going to be dangerous for Saskatchewan. We make shoveling sexy. Cannot believe we've never done this, but we did it today.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get started with some of that social media content we talked about after your Out of Context clip.
Give it a goodness! Yeah!
Woo! Oh.
The Beckler and Shauna Podcast.
Well, I did it, Beckler. I made my first snow dong yesterday.
This is really funny.
So we've been talking about this for a couple of days, okay? Because,
Mostly on our podcast.
Mostly on our podcast, and then yesterday early in the morning. But it was my first winter weenie that I made. So I live on the 31st floor of my building, and it overlooks this lot.
In Stampede Grounds.
Yeah. And it's this blank slate of a lot that nobody ever parks in. And so always I see when there's a fresh snowfall, I'll see the odd person who's doing a donut there. But mostly it's just this lot that is crisp and clean and still has all the snow.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I saw that, I was like, well, you know, there's probably something that should be done there. And you mentioned, you were like, maybe you should try and write a message or something.
Yeah, do some sort of message or illustration on that clean canvas of a lot.
So, a couple days ago, I went and did some recon to see if I could and see if the snow was sticking in that lot. But it was actually too warm 2 days ago because the ground was still warm.
Right.
So, all the snow we got had already melted. So, I couldn't use it then. And yesterday, I went again, and I had to pay $18 to get into the parking lot 2 days in a row.
Both times,
because there were events going on in Stampede. So
dedication
I got to the front.
To the bit.
There's people behind me, too. So the first time, I was like, if I'd known that, I would have been like, I'm good. But I was already lined with the lineup, and I was like, okay, here's my $18. Yesterday I did again, and the snow was there, and I made a giant snow dong that you can see from my 31st balcony.
Yeah, it's pretty, like, it turned out better than I thought it was going to.
Me too.
Like, in the video that you shot, you zoom in on it from your window,
yes.
And, like, you can see it, and you can tell that it's a huge, huge wiener in the snow. It's
it's a snow bean.
I mean, your dinksmanship is impressive on this, Shauna.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I didn't know how to really even do it, and there's two ways you could make it happen. There was the symmetrical way that I did it, or the one with the gonads below. People had some arguments as to which way I should have gone, but I was trying to do it with the wheels of my tire in a way where I had to follow along the lines, and it's a little more skilled than you'd think it was.
It's not like there's courses you can take on how to do this. You're making it up as you go along.
Yeah, that's just it. So I gave it my first go, and I think it went pretty well.
I do
people
too.
Seem to approve of it. So,
yes.
We have a couple friends, actually, who have a penthouse that live where they also overlook Stampede Grounds. So I texted them yesterday. I was like, hey, do you see the snow They sent a picture back, and they're like, yeah, there it is. So,
I mean, there are lots of buildings down here that are high enough that could probably see that parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then anybody who flies over the city. Wow. Unfortunately, it's probably gone by now, right? Because we've had more snow. They probably have cleared the parking lot by now.
This is a question of how many times do I keep doing
at $18 a pop?
Doing it at $18 a pop. Somebody mentioned, it's posted on all our social medias right now, so you can find it on
Hex's
socials.
It's worth checking out. It's super funny.
And somebody just mentioned that they would actually start a GoFundMe to keep the project going.
And your dinksmanship is only going to improve as you go.
That's just it. I was thinking of different ways I could make it more pronounced for next time, and I've got some ideas, okay?
The Beckler and Shauna podcast.
Are you familiar with the term trypophobia, Shauna?
Yes.
Yes. So it's basically like when you see certain patterns or holes and it makes you really uncomfortable. Some people say they feel itchy, they feel kind of grossed out by it. It's not an official mental disorder, according to the DSM-5, but lots of people experience these feelings of disgust when
it's
they see
it. It's become a big thing recently, hey? Like, somebody, I guess, kind of just pinpointed that they have this feeling, and everyone's like, yeah, I feel that too. It's weird.
In the last few years on the internet is when it's kind of been given a name, even though many people have felt this their whole lives, but just didn't know that there was a word for it. The word is trypophobia. But anyway, I've been noticing it all over the city this week with the way that the slush freezes to vehicles.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it looks, especially on the sides and on the back and stuff, like, it freezes in this kind of, like, disgusting pattern that makes it look like vehicles are growing something, like they have a disease.
Especially if you're, let's say, parked on the side of a road and a plow or something comes by, or someone sprays up that nasty slush stuff and that sticks, that's the worst, because then it just gets right caked on there.
Like, as I've been driving around the last few days, I've just been seeing all these, like, vehicles that look so gross.
Yeah.
And so I went out last night with Bo and Brigham, and we tried to find some examples in our neighborhood. And I got a few photos of what I'm talking about here, if you don't know.
Yeah.
And I wrote a blog about it at x99.ca, kind of explained a bit more about the phenomenon known as trypophobia.
Yeah.
And how Calgary seems to be unique, and with our freeze and thaw cycle, that the conditions are perfect for our vehicles to have that sort of like fungusy look. It reminds me of the title sequence from The Last of Us.
Oh, yeah, that's
which
gross.
Which is so gross.
Yep. For some reason, I'm thinking of Pirates of the Caribbean and the way that the they kind of meld into the side of the ship. Do you remember?
Yeah, don't like that at all.
Nope, sorry.
Nope.
That's,
I'm not even looking at it right now, and I don't like it.
I know. Gross.
It's gross.
Gross.
Gross, but if you can handle it, if you can stomach it, I have some examples, some photo examples at x99.ca that I took around town last night.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like it, maybe you don't want to.
Maybe you'll want to avoid that.
Gross.
The Beckler and Shauna podcast.
Well, there's a whole lot of shoveling to be done.
Is there ever?
And the snow is continuing, isn't it? I know, right? And everybody has been constantly, you have to keep up on it, right?
Because
how do we still have that? Is it 24 hours?
I believe so.
Walks?
Yeah, and it gets packed down if you don't go out there quick, and then it's a real pain in the ass.
Yes. And I was thinking, I was like, have we ever made shoveling sexy?
I couldn't believe this, because Make It Sexy, I think, is the oldest segment that we have on this show. It's almost as old as the show itself.
It really
is. The show is coming up on 10 years. So.
And shoveling is something that we have to do so often here. And
yeah.
We have winter every single year. I know. I got thinking about this and I was like, we must have made shoveling sexy in the past. But we haven't.
I looked through our archives and I couldn't find anything. And when I started to think about it, I was like, no, I don't believe we have, which is amazing.
Crazy. Well, we can do this. We can help you guys, okay? We can make this because it's something that
a lot of people don't like. I don't mind shoveling. I actually don't mind it at all, but a lot of people dread it.
A lot of people hate it. And it is. You have to get out there in the cold. And
especially in late March and when it just keeps falling and falling like this. So yeah, let's do it.
We can help.
Let's make shoveling
sexy.
Ooh, it's so wet and heavy. I can hardly lift it.
That's real heavy. Better grab the shaft with both hands.
You want to get at it before it's been packed down by too many people.
Don't overexert yourself, though. It can really get the heart pumping.
There's been too much dumped in the front. I'll have to push it around to the back and dump it there.
That's a big load. Toss it over your shoulder. Dump it on your neighbors if you have to.
The Beckler and Shauna Podcast.
I also had, this job is too big for just one person. I need help from a friend or perhaps a machine. Mm-hmm. That works too.
That's pretty good. I also had, put your back into it. Of course, because, you know, yep.
Make It Sexy is a polarizing segment, though.
It is.
I know, like, there's some people who love it. Like someone texted us right after that and was like, can I get that clip? That made my whole morning. And then there's some people like, I know my dad hates it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I got a feeling we have some new bosses here. And I got a feeling they're not going to be crazy about it. But
no,
like we said, it's almost as old as the show.
It really is. It's we can't not make things sexy. Okay. We can't. I can't believe though. I really can't believe that we haven't done that in the past.
No, because any of the seasonal ones that come up every year, like, you know, taxes, allergies, the different holidays and stuff, like we've done them all.
Yeah.
We've done like 200 of these.
Yes.
And not shoveling.
Wow. No.
So that's good. We remedied that today.
We did. We took care of that for you.
It's also a lot of fun that Shane Holmes seems to be pretty cool with
yes, thank you.
The things that we talk about, because I mean, they're willing to sponsor the show, so they obviously don't take that stuff too seriously.
No.
Which we appreciate.
We really do.
God bless you, Shane Holmes.
They all have good sense of humor from what I've gathered.
I think so, yeah.
And we've hung out with them too.
And like are willing to be like real about it and be honest about it. So
totally.
We appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Thank you to Shane Holmes for sponsoring this PissCast. Learn more about them at ShaneHolmes.com. Shane Holmes.
The better way to build.
The Beckler and Shauna Podcast.
Friend of the show, Craig, sent me a picture of a product that I did not know existed. 6.1% Pilsner.
Is this the same company that does Pilsner?
Yeah.
Like the traditional
old style Pilsner? They just have a stronger version of it now. It comes in like a black box and a black can. Huh. And normal Pilsner is 5%. Yep. This is 6.1.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. It looks like trouble, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Looks like trouble in a can.
Yeah, it sure does. Wow.
So Craig is a big Snurs guy. He actually came to my Halloween party this past year in full Pilsner gear. Like a Pilsner superhero was his.
That was his costume?
Yeah, big Snurs guy.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Big Snurs guy. So it doesn't surprise me he was the one to inform me of this 6.1% Pilsner.
Well, I'm shocked because, so when I go to Saskatchewan, I only drink Pilsner. Mm-hmm. It's my rule. So the minute I get there, like here, I'll drink craft beer all the time, and that's my favorite type of beer. But the minute I go hit that border of Saskatchewan,
when in Rome,
Pilsner.
Right? When in Rome.
But I sometimes do like a little heavier a drink.
Oh.
So I would love to see the 6.1%. I haven't seen it yet, or else I would be buying the 6.1% Pilsner.
It must be fairly new, because I haven't seen it on a shelf yet either. But
okay, that's exciting. So I can, jeez. That's not good for Terry, though.
Well, that was my question.
Yeah, no.
Did we need this?
No.
Was that a problem?
No.
Was anyone like, you know, I'm concerned Terry isn't getting drunk fast enough?
No.
Poor guy's been out there slamming Snurs all afternoon and he doesn't even have a buzz going.
And Terry won't even know. Like, this is the thing, is he'll look at the 6.1 and think he can handle it just like he can the 5%.
Oh, he is not adjusting his pace.
Oh, man, there's going to be some fights, man.
At all.
Oh, we need to be careful. It needs to come with a label. It should come with a very, very...
Yeah.
large label, a warning label.
Like, caution, Terry.
Yes.
Gear down, Big Rig.
And Terry's old lady just being like, make sure if Terry's on this one, you keep an eye on him.
I mean, really, a 12-pack should be like a 10-pack.
Yes.
Like I said, Terry's not going to adjust his pace.
No,
he at all. Not. He's going to drink those like he drinks regular old-style Pilsner.
Stranger danger right there.
And like you said, the fights, they cannot serve this at sporting events in Saskatchewan. Mm-mm. That's how you get Donnybrooks.
Every time I go there, I die laughing because it's always only light beer at sporting events in Saskatchewan.
Because they know.
They know. As somebody who likes craft beer, I'm like, right, where am I? No, we'll go for the 4%ers. Thank you.
Yeah, we tried the heavier stuff once.
Didn't go well for Terry.
The incident happened, and we don't talk about that.
The Beckler and Shauna Podcast. Beckler and Shauna's Career Day.
It seems the biggest entertainment genre in the world right now is true crime. And if you're one of these people who can't get enough of hearing about homicides and their investigations, our next Career Day guest is going to be right up your alley. Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
My name is Dave Sweet, and I am a retired, veteran police officer with the Calgary Police Service. I spent 25 years working with the police and retired last October. The last 15 years, I've spent working in our homicide unit. Today, I am an author, a public speaker, and a consultant.
You've written a book called Skeletons in My Closet, 101 Life Lessons from a Homicide Detective. And I imagine some of the things we'll talk about are also in that book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I back in 2018, myself and my co-author, Sarah Graham, authored a book, Skeletons in My Closet. And yes, it's 101 Life Lessons, things I learned through my career policing in the city.
Why don't we start at the beginning, Dave? How did you get into specifically homicide? I mean, we've chatted with police officers before, so we're somewhat familiar with that process, but how did you end up as a homicide investigator?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, and sometimes still scratch my head and not sure how to answer it because my path led me that way. I started out like everybody else does, as a uniformed police officer driving around answering calls for service. And eventually, I transferred into our drug unit. I spent 3 years working as a drug undercover street officer. I had some success there and was promoted from that unit. Went to our guns and gangs team, spent a couple of years there, and then an opening came up in homicide, and I was asked to apply for it, which I did.
Were you hesitant when you first applied, wondering if you could handle it, or at that point were you just so used to, you know, some of the things that you might see?
I was hesitant more on not whether I could handle the types of crime that I was going to be investigating, but more hesitant on the potential effect it would have on the family and the family unit. Yeah. I mean, it's a lifestyle. You know, the members that are working in there, when it's busy, they're working 55, 60 hours a week. There's not a lot of opportunity for balance during that heightened time. And so I was always like conscious and aware of it, but also so grateful that for the opportunity to have the experience, because I think I really, for myself anyways, I grew so much from it, more so than I thought I ever would, to be honest.
Do you know any of the stats from your career as a homicide investigator? How many murders you investigated? How many you solved?
Well, that's a good question. I know that I was involved in about 600 death investigations.
Okay.
So a good number of those were homicides, but we also investigated deaths that were deemed suspicious by the Office of the Medical Examiner. We investigated all deaths in water. And we investigated any death involving a child under the age of 3.
Okay.
But in total, about 600. And when I left my career, I turned over 2 files to our cold case team. Yeah.
Do you ever get used to seeing a dead body?
I mean, yes, I think you do, actually. You kind of touch on that point on, you know, how do you deal with difficult things? I think the question kind of speaks to that. And I think that, you do with experience and with time. And a little bit of acclimation, you do get used to it. But there are certainly times still, you know, there were occasions where you'd walk into a scene and your knees would still go weak and your mind couldn't really compute sort of what was in front of you, I guess. But for the most part, yeah, you did get used to it on some level, just through repetition of it, yes.
When you first come into a scene, specifically, what would you be looking for? And how are you kind of keeping your biases in check so you don't jump to conclusions, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so when you do any kind of an investigation, any kind of death investigation, I guess you're sort of looking for three different things. So the scene itself is going to provide you some information through the evidence that you collect at the scene, but it's one part of a sort of a larger equation when we go to the death investigation, because the second piece you have to consider is the history of the decedent, you know, their background, what may have led to their passing. And then thirdly, there'll be an examination of the body at an autopsy. And that piece is also very, very important in trying to understand how somebody died. So the scene is one thing, but you will be biased if you only base it on the scene itself. If I could give you just a very quick example.
Please.
You're a police officer. You walk into a scene. There's somebody laying on the floor. They have a gun in their left hand. They have a gunshot wound in their chest. On the calendar, it says, you know, March 20th, 2024, very last day here. Based on what you see at the scene and only the scene, you may be forming an opinion that this person took their own life. Mm-hmm. But when you delve into the history of this individual, you might learn that they have a drug background. You might learn that on their phone, there's some messages from a guy by the name of Weird Harold that says if he doesn't pay up, he's coming over to collect. And you might find out from the family that your decedent is right-handed, not left-handed. That completely changes the perspective of what you just saw at the scene itself. And that information from the history is very, very important as well. It is also evidence. So to fix this whole thing and to try and figure it all out, perhaps it's going to be the autopsy and the examination of the body that's going to lead ultimately to the sort of final conclusion of, is this a homicide or is this a situation where someone has made the decision to take their own life?
How much do you rely on witness testimony when you go to court when you're building your case as opposed to forensic evidence?
Yeah, so, you know, forensic evidence, of course, is very, very important. It has its failings, just like witness evidence does. Of course, DNA, for example, can't be timelined. You can't say when somebody deposited DNA at a scene, for example, or when fingerprints were left behind at the scene. But forensics and witness evidence in combination can present a fairly powerful case in court, but I don't think you can, like, look at one particular piece of evidence and say that's, you know, on its own is the strength of the case. It's sort of the totality of things as you move through. So witness evidence, as I think most of us are aware, can be different. Every witness sees things differently through their own eyes, and you often will get some discrepancies or just some inconsistencies between witnesses. And so although it can be relied upon, it's not the only thing, right? It's a combination of that and the forensics that seem to help.
Is there a case that you are particularly proud of in solving? Maybe one that was extremely misleading that you kind of, you know, figured out, or?
Well, I mean, I was part of some, if you think back in the city's history of last 15 years, I was part of some of the cases that were very, very high profile, attention grabbing. Yeah. But I think that, you know, some of the ones that I'm most proud of are the ones that weren't that way. They were ones where you really had to work with witnesses behind the scenes to get them to court, to give their evidence. Often in cases of homicide, our victims and our witnesses come from backgrounds where there's maybe not so much trust in the police and that kind of thing, trust in the process. And so some of the cases I'm most proud of, one that I'm thinking of is it was a domestic homicide. But our victim in that case, you know, she lived on the fringes. The witnesses that we had that were going to come and speak on her behalf also lived on the fringes and did have difficulty trusting the police. So working really, really hard with them behind the scenes to make sure that they were going to show up on to court that day and so to provide that evidence to bring that victim's murder to justice was something I still to this day feel proud that I was able to do in collaboration with a number of other team members.
Do your witnesses ever worry? Do they ever worry about retaliation, especially if we're talking about maybe organized crime?
Yeah, I mean they certainly do. You know, when we think about fear, that is one of the big ones that prevents people from coming forward. It's this sort of this fear of retaliation or this, you know, retribution is coming. It can be realistic depending on where that witness is placed in the crime. You know, an eyewitness, the little nosy old neighbor that's looking out the blinds and sees the murder occur, she's probably not as at risk for retribution as maybe a friend of the accused, for example, who may come forward and speak. But to be honest with you, in the years that I investigated murders, never once did we have a witness end up a victim, which was something that was important to know. I think sometimes the fears that we have about it come from the things that we watch on TV and the movies and things of that nature, but that fear is actually quite unrealistic when it comes to the actual statistics.
How do you tell these people or get them to trust you then and say, you know, get them to testify essentially?
Right. Well, I think it's addressing those fears and handling those fears and listening to them and then providing your own perspective on why this is important and working with them to try and overcome some of the things that might be holding them back or preventing them from coming forward.
You obviously have seen a lot of the darkest parts of society through this job, but what is the best part of that job?
Oh, the service to the people and the community and the families. You know, through my career, I was just blessed to meet some amazing people, people who went through incredible strife and suffering and came out on the other side doing okay, you know, and being sort of inspired by them and the relationships that you sort of forge as an investigator into the families themselves, the ones that want a relationship with you. Some of those relationships today still exist and last, and I'm so grateful for them. So that's the best part, was the service to the family and the community.
And obviously you've watched a ton of cop shows, and I'm sure people ask you all the time, what's the biggest misconception on a cop show and which one's the most realistic?
So you're going to love, I don't know if you'll love this answer, but so when I watch some of the shows, the biggest misconceptions are the type of evidence the police can collect. And I think a lot of those shows make the police look like, as long as we have fingerprints and DNA, that, you know, we can solve the crime. And that misconception sort of leads to cases becoming unsolved. The reality of it is that the police can only go so far with the evidence. They still need people to come to court and be talking heads to help clarify some of the things that we see. So, for example, we might collect CCTV video of somebody prior to a crime or prior to a murder, and we may have really good images, but we still need somebody to come to court and say that that person is this person, and they know them, have known them for the last 10 years. You know, so that's something that TV's shows don't necessarily capture, but it's something that's really, really important. And the show that I think that describes the police environment the best, and I say it with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, but it is true, Brooklyn Nine-Nine has done a fantastic job in characterizing a police office, I think. Of course, the crimes in there are a little corny and things of that nature, but the actual characters and the way they're sort of portrayed on that show, I think you can find one of those in every unit with any police organization across the globe.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
So my last question for you, Dave, how have you taken all of this experience and turned it into a career as a speaker and an author? Like when you give a speech, what are you touching on? What are the topics?
Yeah, I mean, I talk a lot about resiliency. I talk a little bit about courageous leadership. This week, I'm doing a lecture at the university on ethics. And I also take relatable police experiences, like how we go through the process of investigating a crime, and I can apply to that to things like project teams. The experience interviewing a suspect in an interview room is very similar to what actually happens in a sales room floor. I used to say I sold life sentences, and I did. I used to sell people on the idea that if you talk to me, you know, you're going to get an opportunity to tell your side of the story. But by doing that, they would secure themselves essentially a conviction in that interview.
Wow.
But people still did it. And so I talk a little bit about some of the techniques and things that we do in an interview room that help create the most likely positive outcomes for us and how people can apply that into their own lives. So some of the speaking I do is on that particular topic as well.
Now, what, one more really quickly, what's the best piece of advice you have for somebody maybe looking to get into this career?
Well, just, you know, follow your heart. One of the things people don't necessarily understand when it comes to policing is there's a sort of this, it starts when you're really young. It's just this desire. There's some sort of, it's like, it really truly does feel like a calling for a lot of people. And so the first piece of advice is follow that calling and follow your heart on it. I think the police service benefits from people from all walks of life. And so don't be afraid to, instead of taking a criminology program, go and take a business program at the university, just in case it doesn't work out or it's not what you want. You have something to fall back on. But I think getting into policing is, means like leaving most of your doors open, and try not to close too many along the way, and making good decisions when you're young that are going to afford you the best possible opportunity to become a member of the police service.
Where can we find your book and more about you, Dave?
Sure. So my book is available in Calgary at Pages in Kensington and at Owl's Nest Books in Britannia. It is also available for order online. And probably the best way to purchase the book would be to go directly through my website, which is the www.unconventionalclassroom.ca.
Dave Sweet is a retired homicide investigator and the author of Skeletons in My Closet, 101 Life Lessons from a Homicide Detective. We appreciate your time this morning, Dave. Thank you, man.
Thanks so much, Dave.
I appreciate it, too. Thank you both, and I wish you a lovely day in the snow here.
The Beckler and Shauna Podcast.
I was listening to a song by Noah Kahan. Do you know the song Forever? Beckler?
I don't think I do, no.
Okay, so in the song, he does a woo, and it's the saddest woo I've ever heard in my life. If you woo in a song, it needs to be a woo that you respect,
it's gotta
okay?
be a big woo.
This is just, listen, okay? This is a sad, sad woo.
I won't ever let her go.
It's almost, when I heard that, I was like, I'm sorry, was that... No, that's not how we woo in songs, okay?
Noah Kahan is a sad boy, though.
He is, he's, but that song boy actually picks up right after that, and I'm like, you can't woo. Like that's not, no, that's not convincing when I said anything, okay? But it got
punch
me thinking.
Your woo.
Yeah, you need
sad to. Sad as woo, partying with Noah Kahan.
You could not be a woo girl, Noah Kahan. You are not a good Yay. Wooer, okay? Then I was thinking about good woos in songs, because there are some songs that have some decent woos. But here's the thing. When I got thinking about it further, I was like, it was tougher to find woos than I thought, because there's one that I think is the pinnacle woo.
I wonder if it's the one I'm thinking of.
Well, what are you thinking of, is it?
Your boyfriend will love this, but it's the start of Crazy, Crazy Nights by
Okay,
Kiss.
It's not. Give it to me.
Oh, okay. This has a great woo. I just want to make sure I got this turned up so it hits you right in the
teeth.
Yeah,
I want to hear it. Woo! Okay.
That's how you woo.
That might be
Listen
the woo.
Listen to how hard he woos.
That's, woo! All right.
And it kicks the song off?
Yeah, all right. That's.
What did you have?
I had this one right here.
Woo! Great woo.
Okay, it now I'm wondering.
That had some conviction. And
which
it also
of those
kicks
two?
The song off.
Because the other ones I thought of, like Blur has woo-hoo, but that's not the same. I don't count a woo-hoo.
You don't count
a
woo-hoos?
Do you? Like. And actually, it's weak even when you hear it out loud. The other one, this is not a woo, but it's a Martin Mall. Ow! That's not
Ow!
A woo. That's a...
Ow!
Yeah,
Ow!
Not a... Woo! No, no, we need a woo.
Ow!
Yeah, that was good. Yeah! No,
man,
I thought it...
Not that long
good.
Ago in the show, we talked about James Brown. And
no.
He's good. He makes all kinds of sounds,
You're
though.
Right.
He had that one where he just went, scream!
And I don't count that. Because, yes, that's what he does. He makes any sound, he just screams.
Michael
and just
Jackson
owns
has
it.
Some good woos. Good woos. Scrimp is the fun. Scrimp! You just, whatever you feel, you just let it out.
I want to say, can we bring scrimp instead of woo? Let's, instead of songs in the future having woos, or the saddest boy woo, that is Noah. Come on now.
Oh, the Beckler and Shauna Podcast. Etymology with Shauna.
So I have the etymologies of a couple different places in your home again, Beckler. We started this yesterday.
We talked about threshold.
Threshold, yes. Thresh being straw.
Yep.
So the threshold is because, long story, you can catch that on our podcast if you want. I won't get into it again. But here's one for you. Dormitory.
A dormitory.
So that comes from medieval times. And so back then, medieval farmhouse lofts were often reached by an outside ladder to a door from the roof.
Yeah, you can still see that on like old barns and stuff.
Yeah. So with the adoption of inside stairs, that room began to be used for sleeping because it made it much easier to get to that room. So instead of being an outside thing, of course, you're inside. So that became the kind of place to sleep. But that door eventually that was outside was replaced with a window.
Okay.
And yeah. Window in French is dormer.
Mm.
So really, when we say dormitory, you're essentially just saying window room. Really.
Okay.
But that's where that comes from. It kind of came from the medieval farmhouses, and when, yeah, that room became a sleeping quarter, because that, of course, is what your dormitory is, so.
And modern dormitories, they have one, like, the rooms have one door and one window, typically, right?
Yep.
You don't have a balcony or anything like that?
Nope. And you think of college dorms, yeah. That kind of stuff? Yeah, if you have, if you even have a window, you're lucky. Mine was cinder blocks and terrifying.
You didn't have a window?
No. It was
an interior?
Sorry, it was like a very, very tiny, tiny little window, because I think you legally have to have just that.
I was going
to
say.
But it was terrifying in there.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Okay.
And then the next one is foyer.
The foyer.
So in the mountains of eastern France, the front doors of the houses opened into this room-sized shaft, and it went right to the roof, and then there was a pair of opening flaps at the top. And this room was used to bring in light. It was also an escape hatch in case there was so much snow that they couldn't access the front doors.
Wow.
So you had to climb up into this shaft and get out the hatch up that ladder, the hatch there.
Man, they must be getting some serious snow if houses were designed with a way out with that in mind.
Totally. But it was also used as a fireplace room or a place to cure hams and cure your meat and then roast it in that room because they had the opening.
It's a natural chimney, right?
So it was a natural chimney as well. And the French word for fireplace is foyer.
So it's a fireplace room.
But so when
for
you say,
us, it's your front room.
It's it. When you first walk into, you know, your house, you call that the foyer, and it's because it used to be where you kind of fire up some meats and do all kinds of stuff as well, and also the escape hatch.
That's right.
The escape hatch
with Shauna.
The Beckler and Shauna podcast.
I think I've landed on one of the biggest casual insults that you can lob at someone in 2024.
Okay.
Because my dad said it to my mom, and she got pretty defensive, as I think most of us would.
Okay.
He's like, geez, you're on your phone a lot, hey? She was like, no, I'm not, no, I had to look this up. You're on your phone more than I am. Everyone's on their phones, right?
Yeah, that's a huge one.
That's how we all react now.
Because yes.
Nobody wants to be the person in the group who's glued to their phone.
Nope.
It's like, it's a weakness. It's an embarrassment.
It really is. It's funny you bring this up because I say that to my boyfriend quite a bit because when we're together, he's alone a lot when he gets home from work. And you can tell that that's his habit now of going straight to his phone and looking on it. And so we'll be together and it's like, dude, like you, I'm here now. You don't have to go on your phone, but it's just such a natural thing we always do now.
Muscle memory for him, probably.
Yeah,
hey, if
is.
You have even a moment of boredom, you pull out your phone.
Yeah. And we've talked about this before, but I have a friend who's amazing that way, where if we're out, her phone's gone. And she will not take it out until we are done, unless there's like a really, it's like we're going to plan something and then she'll make a point. But she'll put it away entirely for this reason, so that she and I will have full, you know, face-to-face conversations. And so she, when she started doing that, inspired me to do the same. So
good for her. Yeah, I think, like I don't even, lately I've been trying to keep it out of sight if I'm not on it. Like I don't even want it sitting on a table or anything. I just, it's a presence that doesn't need to be there in your interaction, right?
Yeah.
But it's funny because McKenna and I will do this to each other too. And I probably am on my phone quite a bit for work, right?
Yes.
And she'll be like, oh, you're on your phone a lot. I'm like, no, you're on your phone a lot. Or when she's on her phone, I'll be like, hey, you almost done there? And we both get super defensive.
Yeah,
like,
it is a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone's like that now.
Yeah.
It's funny because I will make a point, because you say with work, you know, there's a lot of times where with ideas or stuff, we will, like, I want to write something down for work.
And if I don't write it down, it's gone.
Yes.
So I got to write it down right then.
And with my friends, when I'm out, I will make a point now of saying that. I'll go to get my phone. I'll be like, I'm so sorry. I just have to write something down for work, just so they know that I'm not like bored with the conversation. I'm like, I'm going to start just perusing on Instagram right now.
And actually, in that case, because I do the same thing with my friends, it's it's the opposite. It's like, what you've said is so interesting.
Yes.
I'm going to write it down and talk about it on the radio.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's a reason that I'm on my phone. But yeah, if you really want to piss someone off in 2024,
oh, yeah,
accuse them of being on their phone too much.
Oh, yeah.
The Beckler and Shauna podcast.
Friend of the show, Danielle, submitted a Terry of the Month nominee for us. I don't know if you did any good Terry content when I was away, Shauna.
You know what, Beckler? I did not.
It's been pretty quiet for Terry lately.
Quiet on the
show.
On the Terry front, yeah.
Terry's just been behaving themselves. This one is good, though. So it's this dude on Instagram, at Clintown, and he lives in Victoria, and he's driving, and he's filming his gauges on his dash, which you're probably not supposed to be doing, but his odometer is at 80,084 kilometers, and he's waiting for it to roll over to 80,085 so that it says boobs. Here's Terry.
Okay, here we go.
I've shortened this a bit because it's really wrong.
Come on, baby.
Oh.
Give it to me now. Give me the goodness. Give me the goodness. Yeah! Woo!
Oh, yes. Speaking of woos.
Great woo there, wasn't it?
That's a woo.
Strong woo.
That's a way to woo.
Woo with conviction.
That's a Terry woo right there.
Just because his odometer says boobs and kilometers.
You know what? Good for him.
The funniest part about this, man, is this video is like really blown up, and all of his gauges, he's Canadian, so all of his gauges are in metric, and the Americans are so confused by this. They're like, that's what's funny. Because it says 3 degrees Celsius. Right. They're like, what's C for temperature?
And oh,
like,
my God.
What's... kilometers.
We're teaching some Americans a little bit about that too.
Yeah, though, he's going Terry. Almost 100 miles an hour while filming. There's 100 kilometers now. It's still probably too fast to be filming. But
it probably is, yeah. But these Terry's are the little pump. Things, okay? These are the little things that we need to continue to enjoy.
Like putting when your odometer says boobs?
Or making a giant snow peen. Yeah.
Yeah! Woo!
You've been listening to the Beckler and Shauna podcast.
Brought to you by Shane Holmes, offering affordable customization on your new home.
You want more? Then tune in to X Mornings with Beckler and Shauna live on Calgary's Alternative, X92.9. Monday through Friday, 6 to 10 a.m. Mountain Time at x92.9.ca. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and have Beckler and Shauna downloaded daily to whatever device you use. Later.